Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Booz Allen Hamilton, strategy and technology consultants, at boozallen.com/ready-for-what's-next. And from LendingTree, with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process, at LendingTree.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of people that are admitted to hospitals worry not only about the problems that got them there, but also about hospital-acquired infections. Infections from antibiotic-resistant bacteria that live in hospitals and can find their way into surgical incisions, IV sites, or catheter sites. These bacteria are known as MRSA, M-R-S-A, an acronym for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. My guest, Maren McKenna, has written a new book about the menace of MRSA called Superbug. In the book, she describes how a strain of this antibiotic-resistant bacteria is now living outside hospitals, in the community, and how it's spread into the food chain. McKenna is a science and medical reporter who covered the Center for Disease Control for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She's now a contributing writer at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Maren McKenna, welcome to Fresh Air. We've talked about MRSA on the show before, but your book was really was really scary because I learned all these things I didn't even know about it. So let's start with the basics. MRSA isn't just resistant to antibiotics. It's more lethal than many other bacteria. What kind of damage can it do?
The interesting thing about MRSA is that it does an extraordinary amount of things that it's taken a number of years for people to figure out. So MRSA is an acronym, M-R-S-A, and the S-A stands for Staphylococcus aureus, which is a very large grouping of bacteria that have been with mankind for probably as long as we've been human. And you can tell that because there's a lot of tricks that it has for getting around our immune systems. And it lives with us on our skin, in our nostrils, often without causing very much difficulty, until it can get inside our bodies through a scrape or a cut in the skin or an incision made for say, a catheter. Then it can cause infestations of the valves of the heart. It can infect the inside of bones. It can cause very large abscesses, collections of pus that are walled off inside muscles. More recently, it's been discovered that it doesn't actually need a cut or a break in the skin in order to cause disease, to cause illness. It can also start an infection on what looks like intact skin and cause what medicine calls a skin and soft tissue infection, which sounds like not a big deal, but can turn into a very large infection that requires surgery to get better.
So tell me, can the benign, the seemingly benign staph that's residing in my nostril turn into this antibiotic-resistant infection if it enters a wound in my own body?
Yes. That was probably figured out first in the 1960s when they started to be really good at microbiology, and they noticed that people who had staph infections, the infections were caused by the same strain that these people were carrying around in their nostrils. So it's possible either that someone is carrying a staph strain with them and infects themselves, or that in a setting like a hospital, they pick up a strain from, say, a healthcare worker or someone else coming into the hospital and have an infection caused by that instead.
Not to dwell on this too long, but does that mean, like, don't pick your nose if you have a cut? Or, like, what does it mean?
Right. It means, you know, for this bacterium that is causing a worldwide epidemic that we haven't really fully sussed out the size of yet, it turns out that some of the things we can do to defend ourselves, in fact, have to do to defend ourselves, are the sort of things that your grandmother would have told you to do. Don't pick your nose. Wash your hands a lot. That's pretty much it.
Okay, so MRSA is famous for being a hospital-acquired infection. Why does this resistant bacteria dwell in hospitals?
People who are in hospitals are really good targets for infection. If you were a bacterium, you'd probably really like to live in them because their immune systems are damped down in a number of ways. They might be elderly. They might be taking chemotherapy either for HIV or for cancer. They might have had a lot of other antibiotics already that damp down the immune system. They might have a lot of cuts in their skin because of lines and IVs going in and out. So they present both a lot of portals through which bacteria can enter and also reduced defenses in the body once the bacteria get in. And in addition, there's really tight concentrations of lots of people who share those conditions, who are friendly places for bacteria to grow. And so there's a sort of, it's just a very sweet target for bacteria. Once they're in there, they find it a very fruitful place to be.
Why are hospitals so difficult to get rid of the resistant bacteria once they're in a hospital, whether it's on the floors or the bed rails, let alone being carried by your own healthcare workers?
It's so challenging for so many reasons. And, you know, if it were easy, I think they would have fixed it already, though there are some things that are probably easy that aren't being done yet. There are, as I've just said, lots of sick people. And there are also lots of really busy healthcare workers who, because medicine is so complicated, so technological, and also now with managed care so very, very busy, have a lot of things to do. So there are steps that they may miss. There's a lot of surveys now that say that healthcare workers often miss simple opportunities to wash their hands, sometimes as many as 50% of opportunities, not because they're evil or because they intend to infect people, but because they're distracted and have very, very busy days. And in addition, as you say, there are bacteria, and staph is one of them, that can live on surfaces in hospitals. So unless things were absolutely sterile all the time, it's unlikely that we would be able to make hospitals completely resistant bacteria-free.
I've known about this antibiotic-resistant bacteria. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have known about it. One of the many things I didn't know before reading your book is that resistant bacteria has spread to the community. So it's already been a menace in hospitals, but it's gotten out of hospitals too. How is it being spread outside of hospitals?
MRSA lives not just in people who are debilitated and ill and in hospitals, but on all of us walking around all the time. But it was always thought, from about the 1960s when it first sparked up into the 1990s, that the only place where it was successful in attacking people was in hospitals because they're debilitated and ill. And then in the 1990s, a group of researchers at the University of Chicago noticed that they were seeing infections in children that looked very like those hospital infections. And yet these kids had never been anywhere near a hospital. I mean, they were at University of Chicago because they'd come to the emergency room with these infections, but they had not been in the hospital before. And it turned out that there was a slightly different strain of staph that had adapted itself to live in the community and cause infections that are as serious and sometimes more serious than the ones that were being caused in hospitals.
So how does it compare to the hospital version?
The first signal that something different was going on was that the kids that came to University of Chicago in the mid to late 1990s had infections that were caused by staph, and the staph was resistant, but the resistance pattern of the bacterium was slightly different. It was not resistant to quite as many drugs as the hospital variety. And the second was that it was causing syndromes, illnesses that were slightly different than what was going on in the hospital. In the hospital, someone might have MRSA on the valves of the heart, a staph infection of the heart, endocarditis, because it had gotten into their bloodstream. The kids at the University of Chicago were showing up with very large abscesses buried deep in their muscles. That was not anything that anyone had seen in the hospital patients before. Later on, people started to see abscesses in bone, osteomyelitis, infection of the bone. Those were a slightly different category of illness, and they were also showing up in people who were a new category of patient.
So in hospitals, when MRSA, this antibiotic-resistant bacteria, spreads, it's kind of understandable. People are lying there with open wounds and with catheters. How does the community version of this antibiotic-resistant bacteria spread?
It's still somewhat mysterious because it's only been about 10 years that people have been studying this and not very many people studying it. But it seems that there are a couple of factors that kind of predispose people. The first is it happens in situations where there's a lot of crowding. Think of a prison or an army barracks. It happens in places where maybe hygiene isn't very good, so that there's a lot more bacteria staying on the skin. Again, think of a prison. It happens when people have close skin-to-skin contact, and that probably explains why this tends to happen a lot in athletes, both pro athletes and kids who play school sports, because if a child crashes into another child in a football tackle and one child has this on their skin and the other child gets scraped, then the bacteria can enter their skin there.
Do parents have to worry about their children playing sports in school?
I think they should worry about their kids being clean when they play sports in school. And that sounds so simple. And yet, you know, when I spent time in some schools when I was reporting this book, and there are things that kids do, such as not bringing their uniforms home to get washed very often or letting their shoulder pads get dirty. And then there are things that schools do as well. It was really astonishing to me to discover that kids no longer shower after gym class, because showering after gym class was one of the staple traumas of my adolescence, for sure. And they don't do that anymore. And so if they've picked up a bacterium as they're out, you know, on the football field or field hockey or anything like that, it's going to be on their skin much longer.
So another scary thing I learned from your book is that the drug-resistant bacteria that lurks in hospitals and the slightly different variation of that staphylococcus that is now being spread in communities have merged. They've converged to form like a third kind of resistant version of staphylococcus. And why is this so dangerous?
So for about the past 10 years, since the community strain was first identified, you know, people thought they had this kind of sussed out. There was the hospital strain, and it affected people in hospitals. There was the slightly different community strain, and it affected people who were outside hospitals. When medicine says community, that's got quotes around it. It means kind of anywhere outside the walls of a hospital or a nursing home. But what they started to notice was that people were hospital patients and yet were infected with the community strain, which meant that it behaved slightly differently, caused slightly different syndromes, and also was resistant to different drugs. And then also you can see in some of the microbiology that's been done that people who are out in the community actually now have hospital strains. So what this means is just sort of that it's moving in an unpredictable manner, in a manner that's not very well detected. The reason it's not very well detected is because we still don't really have very good surveillance for MRSA, either hospital or community. And the ultimate point of this is that this makes it much harder to say when someone is detected as having a MRSA infection exactly which drugs are going to work. So you have to use the most intense drugs immediately until you can figure out which of the sort of less important drugs might work for the hospital or the community strain. And the more that we use the most intense drugs, the faster the bug is going to develop resistance against those as well.
It's very frightening to think that drug-resistant bacteria are living not only in hospitals and nursing homes, but they've gotten out to the community, and it could spread in schools and other institutions. But how worried about this should we be? I mean, is this like reaching epidemic proportions, or is it just that we've documented a few cases where this new strain of the antibiotic-resistant staphylococcus has spread?
I think we should be worried, which is not the same thing as being panicked about it. But here's why we should be worried. First, because there does seem to be a really large amount of this out there. One of the best estimates that's been done so far, out of not very many estimates, is that about 1.5% of the population, which is more than 4 million people, walks around with this on their nostrils or in their skin. That's MRSA, not just staph. And we still don't have a perfect understanding of when that carrying around, that bacterial carriage, as it's called, turns into an infection. So we can say that those people are at some degree of risk. The second is that, the second reason to be concerned, is that since we know there's a large amount of it out there, and since we know that bacteria are really good at kind of exchanging and trading resistance factors, it means that there's a big pool of bacterial population out there that is potentially getting more resistant or becoming resistant in unpredictable ways that isn't well measured and detected because we're not looking for it.
What advice would you have for us to try to protect ourselves? Wash our hands? Anything else?
I'm smiling because it's such an overwhelming problem, and yet something as simple as washing our hands does seem to be personally protective. I mean, there are policy things that we should be doing, counting it better, looking for it more. But on a personal level, yeah, washing your hands and asking your kid to shower after football is not a bad idea.
Why is it that bacteria that are resistant to potent antibiotics are vanquished by soap?
So I have to preface this answer by saying that I'm not a chemist and I'm not a microbiologist, but here's my understanding of it. The way that antibiotics attack bacteria is in a particularly designed way. It's as though a key is fitting in a lock. And so when bacteria respond to that and evolve a protection against it or a workaround, it's as though they've shut off the lock. Things like soap and water and hand sanitizers, which contain alcohol or salts, don't attack in that fine pointed way. They're really kind of more like whacking the bacteria over the head with a hammer. I mean, they simply break them open, kill them, and then the friction of either massaging your hands with soap and water or massaging them with a hand sanitizer actually physically washes them away.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Maren McKenna. She's the author of the new book, Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. And MRSA is the acronym for Methicillin-Resistant Staphylococcus aureus. In other words, it's bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. And it's become pretty dangerous. And she's a science and medical reporter. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Maren McKenna. She's a science and medical reporter, and her new book is called Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. MRSA is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. In other words, this is the bacteria that is resistant to antibiotics. I was alarmed to read that there have been a few instances where this antibiotic-resistant bacteria has spread from human to pet to human. How much is that happening? How much has that been documented?
How much it's been happening and how much it's being documented are unfortunately two separate questions. This was really kind of discovered by accident. What turns out to happen is that pets can pick up the human strain of MRSA from their humans because they live with us closely, because we smooch them on the noses. They can hang on to the strain. Not very long term necessarily, but just long enough that if, say, the human has an infection, recognizes the infection, and goes to their doctor and gets antibiotics that do take care of it, by the time the antibiotics are done and the human is clear of the infection, the pet still is holding onto it and passes it back to the human in that same kind of daily interaction that gave it to the pet in the first place. There are families who have had a kind of ping-ponging infection in their household for months or years, and it's not until someone has the thought to check the pet, the cat or usually the dog, that it turns out that that's the missing piece of the family puzzle. Now, Staph aureus, the staph strain that infects humans, the SA in MRSA, is not naturally something that lives in animals. Animals have other staph strains that are unique to them. So it's not surprising that it took a while to figure this out because no one was really looking for MRSA in household pets. And it's just a fairly recent discovery. And again, not yet a lot of research, not a lot of counting to see how much it happens.
Any advice for people who have pets?
Well, veterinarians who have looked at this worry that people are going to overreact. And they say, you know, first, if it happens, it's not your pet's fault. And second, it probably doesn't happen all that often. But if you are one of those unfortunate people or families that seems to have a recurrent staph infection where you get one of these severe skin and soft tissue infections or even something more serious, and you get it treated and it doesn't go away and you do the kind of things that might chase it out of your household, like washing everything down with bleach, and it still doesn't go away, and you have a pet in the household, that would be a good time to check your pet.
One doctor who you follow in the book described MRSA as the perfect pathogen. What makes it perfect in a diabolical way?
The astonishing thing about this bug, once I started reporting on it, I really understood why people spend their entire lives in research on it, is that it's very difficult to not act as though it has a personality because it seems so smart. Now, it's not, in fact, smart. It's the blind persistence of natural selection. But natural selection seems to be working really well for staph. So first, it has all this ability to live with us in a manner that is pretty much unchallengeable. We can't eradicate staph. It's part of our personal flora and part of our environment. Then it has this really sophisticated array of defenses and workarounds for our immune system. It's got abilities to turn on resistance factors. It's got a wide variety of genes that are specific to that. It also produces toxins that destroy muscle and burst cells. And in addition to all that virulence and all this ability to live in our environment and on our bodies, it is very smart in developing resistance as well. I understand why that particular researcher called it the perfect pathogen. And when he said that, it was with a rueful kind of admiration.
Maren McKenna will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with science and medical reporter Maren McKenna. We're talking about her new book, Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. It's about a strain of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that lives in many hospitals and can infect patients. MRSA, M-R-S-A, is an acronym for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. MRSA now has entered the community, and as we'll hear, it's entered the food chain through livestock. What are some of the drugs that stand the chance now of being effective against antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
MRSA turns out to be a really interesting case because, on the one hand, it has become resistant to a wide variety of antibiotics that we use every day. And what all of those antibiotics have in common is a sort of central feature in their chemical structure called the beta-lactam ring. We talk about it as though it's methicillin, but methicillin gave that structure to several families of antibiotics. There are now dozens of them. And so, particularly with the more serious cases, there are only a few antibiotics that are already on the market that are left. The one that everyone talks about is one called vancomycin, but there are some other newer ones, daptomycin and linezolid. The interesting thing is that there are also some older drugs that have been around for a very long time that are off patent, so they're relatively inexpensive, that may work against this as well. The problem is that since they're older drugs, people tend not to do that much research on them because they've been around for a while. They don't make anyone a lot of money when they're sold, and they're just not high on the list of anything that anyone wants to look at. And for the very simple infections, it may turn out that the best thing to do may be not to give people drugs at all. If you just have a simple abscess, it may be that what you do is just kind of incise that and let it drain and heal. So the odd thing about this very challenging bug is that sometimes it takes the very newest things that pharmacology can produce, the very most difficult and expensive drugs. But sometimes it may take only some very simple drugs that we haven't looked at yet, but we need to start looking at, and sometimes maybe no drugs at all.
Antibiotics are such commonly prescribed drugs. I was astonished to read in your book that pharmaceutical companies are not making antibiotics a priority. In fact, they've become a pretty low priority. They're not seen as a financial winner in the industry. Why not?
That actually really amazed me, too. But if you think of a pharmaceutical company as, you know, a business concern that is responsible to shareholders, unfortunately, it makes a lot of sense. Imagine that you are a pharmaceutical company and you want to come up with an antibiotic against something like MRSA. So maybe it's a new antibiotic. So you think the older drugs don't work. This one is going to have a very significant market. So the estimate that you hear a lot is that it takes about $800 million and at least 5 years, maybe 10, to bring a new drug to market. You spend all that money. You invest all that time. And at the end, you have a product for which the bacteria are going to develop resistance within a year or 2 years or 5 years. In some areas, if a hospital sees resistance in maybe 15 or 20% of the particular class of bacteria they're giving that antibiotic for, they'll stop prescribing it because they can't guarantee that it's going to work. So now you have a drug for which you invested tons of time and tons of money that only has a marketplace life of a couple of years. And in addition, maybe people take it twice a day for 10 days. If they have a very bad infection, maybe they take it for a couple of months. If I were that pharmaceutical company, it would make a lot of sense to me to instead make insulin, which people take every day for the rest of their lives, or Cialis or Viagra, which people probably take every day for the rest of their lives as well. There's a much more return on a safer investment there than it is for an antibiotic.
So does that mean our antibiotic research has really fallen behind?
It means that companies have turned away from antibiotic research. There's a point in the book where I run down the names of companies that used to make antibiotics that don't make antibiotics anymore. Now, if you talk to people in the pharmaceutical industry, they will say that the market structure for antibiotics needs to change and they need more incentives from the government in order to do the research that's necessary. I find it difficult to take the position that pharmaceutical companies need more help. And yet, it seems pretty clear that the marketplace is voting that fewer companies are making antibiotics than used to. And if we want more antibiotics or better antibiotics, there has to be something in there that needs to change.
What about the possibility of a vaccine that would inoculate us against resistant strains of bacteria?
If you talk to people who spend their lives researching staph, they will all bring up the possibility of a vaccine. I myself am skeptical of this. Not so much that I think it can't be done, although there have been several attempts that have not done very well so far. They look promising in their early steps, and yet they don't make it all the way through all the trials that are necessary. But what I think is dismaying
this antibiotic-resistant bacteria is that it's gotten into the food chain. And the way it's gotten in there is